Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. That means you can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the things that we've done there. It's been a big year for podcasting. The podcasting network has exploded. It's really grown a lot, so we've added a ton of things. If it's been a minute since you've been over there, you should go check it out. We have a lot of weekly podcasts. We've got some serial podcasts, which are podcasts that sort of drop in seasons. So maybe it's just 12 episodes long under a theme. Stuff like The Soul of Christianity. If you haven't checked that stuff out, go ahead. Maybe you need something to binge. Maybe you have some time off work for the new year, and maybe you're going to be driving a long ways. We got you. We got you covered for that stuff. Also, the year is ending. It's coming to an end. We hope everyone had a very Merry Christmas, even though there's still many days of Christmas left. If you're the liturgical type, you know that Christmas is not yet over. There's still, I think at this point, 10 days or so of Christmas left. But if you're looking for something to do before the end of the calendar year, you say, what should I do? I think there's two things that you could consider. You could consider making a year-end donation to 1517 that would help us out. It would help get the word out, keep us doing what we're doing. And the Here We Still Stand conference, tickets do go up. The price increases, and there are under 100 general tickets left, and the price will go up on the first of the year. And so don't wait around for that. You don't want that to happen to you. Chad, did the actual day of Christmas treat you well? I know that you're still in Christmas. I've been paying attention to Facebook. I've seen the memes where people are really upset, apparently, that some people don't understand that Christmas continues.
Yeah. People are making sure that others realize we are just beginning the Christmas season, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of righteousness tied up in knowing that Christmas is a season.
Right. Yeah, Christmas was good. My wife and I went headed north to the Texas Panhandle and did a short trip in Oklahoma to see our families up there. And we actually had to travel on Christmas Day because I had to work the 26th. So we had a Christmas breakfast with my family. Then we hit the road, 8-hour drive back to South Texas, all within one state.
See, now that's when you listen to this podcast. See, that's when they come in handy, when you're having to do that drive, when you're having to go back from the family and you got 8 hours and you're like, I mean, I guess I could just listen to music or I could converse with this other person. Why do those things when you could be
listening to podcasts?
You could be listening to me and Chad. And that's what you need to do.
I did a little, I read a little bit. I listened to a little bit of podcast and listened to a little bit of the novel that I'm listening to at Audible. So I kind of jump back and forth, keep myself entertained on that long drive home.
Chad, do you ever feel like this is a thing? I feel like this is a thing. I feel like I'm cheating a little bit when I do this. People will ask me, then this year they did ask, be like, hey, what books have you read this year? I know you came out with a list of that. I listed my seven favorite books I read this year. But sometimes when they ask me, what books have you read? And then I include books that I listened to. I feel like I'm cheating. I mean, it's like everyone does. Everyone includes that in the list. They say they include that as books they've read. But like by definition, you did not read the book.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you had to come up with two lists. These are the books I read. And these are the books that some professional narrator read to me.
Right. Yes, it's a wonderful age though, man, that you could do that. I mean, it is without a doubt doubled the amount of books that I have taken in now that I'm able to listen to them as well.
Yeah, because my job involves driving much of the day. I listen probably to at least 3 hours of books every day. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not like 3 hours straight. It's 5 minutes here, 20 minutes there, or something like that. But it really does increase my ability to cover a whole lot more fiction. I don't listen to a lot of nonfiction, but as far as fiction goes, I can cover a lot of stuff, a lot of material that way.
Yeah, and it's I mean, it's a time redeemer is what it is, because what it does is it allows you to. This is what podcasts do too, and books, and you don't have to listen to something that's theological or whatever. You could be listening to any number of things, fiction, novels, or podcasts that don't have anything to do with theology that you like. But what it does do, I know for me, is even topics that I'm interested in that I feel like I don't know enough about. The great thing about podcasts and audiobooks is that you can expand yourself while you're doing things that you have to do. So what you might be, you have to drive, or you're have a job that allows you to do that. Or what, you know, for me, when I'm working on things that are, you know, in the office that are mundane or whatever, but I have to do, I can have that going on. And so you feel like, wow, I doubled up. I got the thing done. And I also, you know, either knocked out a book that I've been wanting to read, whether it's education or not, or maybe I've listened to podcasts on, I took entire, you know, college classes, you listen to a bunch of lectures on something that I'm interested in. And so anyway, I say all that to say that it's a cool thing that we get to do, to be a part of all that, and unique to the age that we live in.
Yes, sir. It's you can do double duty, you can multitask, and I've done the same thing. I've listened to many lectures or classes in the Modern Scholar series. So mm-hmm. you can deepen your knowledge of something you know already, or you can expand your knowledge to something that you really don't know anything about. So go for it.
Yeah,
keep
absolutely.
That mind active.
Absolutely. All right, man. Well, we are jumping back into numbers, and so we are in numbers 20 today.
Numbers 20, yeah. There's really four different episodes that Numbers 20 deals with. The first is very short. It's the death of Miriam. It's kind of, I guess you could say, the chapter is bookended by death, because you've got the death of Miriam at the very beginning, and then you have the death of Aaron at the very end, and then in between that, you've got what I think is the most important segment in this chapter, and that is what happens at Meribah with Moses and Aaron. This is the episode where Moses, because of his unbelief, joined with his actions, is going to be prohibited from entering the promised land. So that's a major episode we'll spend most of our time on. And then in between that and the death of Aaron, you've got a short section that deals with Israel trying to cross through the land of Edom, Edom being the land of the descendants of Esau. And Israel is very, very political. They're very, very careful not to offend Edom, as we'll see it in the end. It really doesn't matter, because those ancient hostilities resurface when Israel tries to pass through that territory. So those are the four sections: the death of Miriam, the episode at the rock with Moses and Aaron, and then the attempt to cross Edom's territory, and then the death of Aaron. So that's what we'll be looking at. So the chapter starts out with just one verse devoted to the death of Miriam. It says that the Israelites arrived in a place called the Wilderness of Zin, that is Z-I-N, in the first month. Now, we're not told what year this is, but when we compare this particular episode with later travel itineraries that we have in the Book of Numbers and elsewhere, this is actually the last year that they're going to be going in circles in the wilderness. So this is the 40th year. So, you know, we've covered a lot of time in these last few chapters in Numbers. Of course, hardly anything is recorded about what happened during those 40 years, just a few episodes here and there. But we're fast forwarding at this point. So we are in the final year. They've almost completed that 40-year sentence in the wilderness. And Miriam is in this first month of that year. She dies at a place called Kadesh, and it says that there she was buried. And that's really all that is said about Miriam. Of course, you'll remember that we met Miriam way back when Moses himself was just a baby boy, when his mom made the little ark and put him in the Nile River, and the princess of Egypt discovered him there and took him in. And Miriam was older. She's the firstborn of that family, and so she was following behind to see what would happen to the boys. So that's our first introduction to Miriam. And then she figures here and there throughout the episodes we've looked at. She's there singing with the other women at the crossing of the Red Sea. She spoke against Moses at one point and was struck with a temporary skin disease, a leprosy kind of disease. And then this is, I think since that episode, we haven't heard anything about her until her death here in the first month of the 40th year. So what you're seeing, especially beginning in this chapter, is really the final chapter in a whole lot of things. This is the final chapter in the life of the leaders of Israel, because, of course, the brother and sister, Miriam and Aaron, are both going to die here. And this is also the final chapter in a whole series of rebellions. This is kind of the, I guess you could call it the crescendo of the rebellions, because we've seen all of the congregation of Israel rebel and complain and murmur multiple times. A couple chapters ago, we saw a rebellion on the part of the leaders and the Levites, Korah and Dathan and Abiram. If you remember everything that happened there, that was 3 or 4 episodes ago. And now we're going to finally see the rebellion of the two top leaders of the Israelites themselves. So you can kind of see everything beginning at the bottom with all the Israelites grumbling. And then the leaders and the Levites, they grumble, they rebel. And now we finally get to the pinnacle of the human pyramid. And Moses and Aaron themselves are going to rebel against the Lord. So in the end, nobody comes out clean. Everybody in one way or another is going to be involved in acting against or speaking against the Lord in one way or another.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that it fast forwards like that, that it just jumps. I think that what that tells you is that this was a legit wandering. When someone says, yeah, I was wandering around, you don't assume that there was a lot of interesting or exciting things going on. And I think the reason that you have this sort of jump forward is that this wandering really was a pretty pointless thing. I mean, if you look at a map, you're like, well, you must have just wandered all over the place. There's just not that much land for you. I mean, 40 years of wandering around that, like this area right here, you know, you must have covered the whole thing in every which way, you know. And so I think that the point of that is that, I mean, obviously this is God's judgment for the rebellion. It wasn't as though all these interesting things were going on. I do think it was probably more of this mundane, repetitive wandering around, just this waiting.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, that in some way is part of the discipline that the Lord imposes upon them, right? Because throughout those 4 decades of this mundane walking around in circles, as it were, living in the midst of a barren, dead wilderness, they could recall what they had lost out on, right? If they had actually believed in the Lord and entered into the promised land, and they would have saved themselves all of those years of barrenness and walking around in circles. So it should have been, it was designed to be a period in which they could recall their past misdeeds and learn from them and be prepared when the time came, when those 40 years were up, to actually enter into the promised land and not repeat the mistakes of their forefathers. Now, what kind of lesson this actually taught them is a whole other question, but what it was designed to do was that. And I think in these next few verses, we'll see that even though it was supposed to be a time when they learned from the mistakes of their fathers, that that learning was far from complete. Because, jumping to verse 2, here's what happened. So it says there was no water for the congregation. We've seen this all, way, way back in the beginning in Exodus chapter 17. Before the Israelites even reached Mount Sinai. So this is within the first 3 months of their departure from Egypt. Already then they didn't have any water. Already then they were complaining. And already then God provided water from a rock. That's many times these two stories that we're about to look at, this one we're about to look at in then Exodus 17, are placed side by side and compared with one another, because there's a lot of parallels between these two. Of course, one happens in the first year. This one happens in the last year. In both of them, God gives water from a rock. In both of them, it's precipitated by the people's complaining. And in both of them, the the staff or the rod of Aaron, of Moses is involved. But as we'll see, what happens here, it doesn't have the positive outcome that that earlier episode had. So the people, there's no water. The people assemble themselves against Moses and Aaron, as they've done many times. And keep in mind, these aren't the same people. These are the children, and in some cases, the grandchildren of the adults who had complained against Moses. I'm assuming by now, almost every single one of the 20-year-old and upward people have perished in the wilderness. So this is, if there's any of them left, then they're going to be dying this year. So almost all of that generation is gone, if not all of it, except for just a few lingering older people. And the children of those people, and in some cases the grandchildren of those people, they are simply walking in the same footsteps, rebellious footsteps, as their fathers and their grandfathers did. So they do the same thing. They assemble against the leadership, against Moses and Aaron. They contend with Moses. And here's what they say. If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beast to die here? And why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? It's not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. Now, this is them taking a page from the actions of their parents, because it's the same thing that we've seen before. And I think it's we've commented on this before, but I think it's just as well to comment again on the fact that most of the time, individuals as well as groups of people don't get better as they get older, or don't get better from generation to generation. I mean, there's sort of a myth out there of moral improvement. But I think usually with age or with generations, but I think what happens most of the time is we don't get better. We simply get better at concealing our faults. That tends to be the way, my observation anyway, when I look at myself and I look at the lives of the other people that I'm aware of. Yeah, yes, there might be some improvement here and there externally, but most of the time we are who we are, and we face the same weaknesses that we've always had. And so if someone looks at us and says that we're getting better, chances are we're just getting better at concealing the inner turmoil and struggles and temptations that we have consistently faced throughout our lives. I think that's the case of the Israelites here, that they're just like their fathers. There isn't any kind of improvement because they are dealing with the same temptations and weaknesses that their parents faced before them. And they're making the exact same complaints that their parents have made.
Well, I think it's pretty evident that they're regurgitating the same complaint, considering that they're complaining about some things that I'm not sure that they've ever even had. They're like, there's no pomegranates or figs over here. And you're like, have you ever even had that stuff? Do you even know what that is? That's a unicorn to you. And if you've been in the wilderness for 40 years wandering around, you know, what are you talking about? I don't think that this generation doesn't seem like they've probably ever had those things. They certainly don't know anything about Egypt.
Yeah. I think you're right. You know, I've experienced this before where there's like an early childhood memory and you don't actually remember it. What you remember is you've created this place, this scenario in your head because you've heard the story told so many times. So maybe your parents tell you about something that happened to you when you were 3 or 4 or 5 years old and you don't remember it, but you've heard the story so much, you've kind of created the scenario in your mind as if you do remember it. And I think something like that's probably happening with the Israelites. So they've heard stories about how wonderful, how much Egypt was like the Garden of Eden, and there was just fruits galore and life was just perfect there. And because this generation of Israelites have heard those stories so many times from their parents and grandparents, it's as if they themselves were there. So they've never tasted a pomegranate, but they can just imagine how good it would be, and they've they've never tasted figs, but they can just imagine how good those must be because they've heard the story so many times.
Yeah, yeah. And just and the way they talk about Egypt, we've seen this before where people that were in Egypt reference Egypt as if it was some great thing. And so, of course, these people who were very young or maybe not many of them not alive at all when they left Egypt, they're like, everything I heard about Egypt sounds wonderful. Like, why I wonder why we ever left. This is probably why it's important for the nation of Israel to have this entire story written down, or else you wouldn't have them generations later talking about what a great thing it was that they left Egypt, because they could go back and read that, oh, unlike the people who were complaining before this was written down, they didn't have any context of how absolutely horrendous Egypt was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very true. And I think part of what's going on here too is kind of what you might call sinner's amnesia. You know, we tend to forget, those things for which we are responsible and remember those things for which we deflect responsibility onto somebody else. So they're blaming Moses, they're blaming God, they're blaming Aaron, they're blaming anybody but their own parents for the situation in which they find themselves. So it's kind of this amnesia that we practice in our own lives, and in which we forget that we are responsible. If there's like suffering going in our life, 99% of the time we're responsible for it, to one extent or another. Of course, not always. There are those occasional situations over which we have no control and for which we're not responsible. But I'd say 99% of the pains and the sufferings that we experience in this life are in one way or another attributable to us. And most of the time, exclusively attributable to us. But we tend to forget that. And in one way or another, we deflect responsibility onto somebody else. And that's kind of what the Israelites are doing here. I mean, they're blaming Moses. They're blaming Aaron. They're blaming God for being stuck in this wilderness. And yet the only reason they're there is because their fathers and mothers refused to enter into the promised land when they had the chance. So what's going to happen? Well, after the people utter the complaint, then Moses and Aaron, they leave the assembly, they go into the tent of meeting, and they fall on their faces as they have done many times. The glory of the Lord appears to them, and God speaks to Moses. And it's important to pay careful attention to exactly what God tells Moses, because this is going to be significant as the rest of the story unfolds. So here's what he says. He says, take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock. Now speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beast drink. There's a couple of things which I think are significant about this. The first is, of course, the command. In Exodus 17, Moses is told to strike the rock, and water comes up. Here, he's told to get the rod, but only to speak to the rock in front of the people. And another thing which is implicit here, and which I find interesting, is that God doesn't seem that upset with the Israelites. Now, in a lot of other places, he's full of wrath, and sometimes a plague breaks out among the Israelites because of their complaining. But in this particular situation, God doesn't utter a single negative word about the Israelites. Now, I don't know why, but I do think it's significant because it departs from many of the other cases where God was, in fact, very upset with the Israelites. But in this case, all he does is tell Moses exactly what to do. Take the rod, speak to the rock, and water is going to come out for the congregation and for their animals to drink. So what happens next? Well, verse 9, Moses starts out good. He follows the instructions. He takes the rod from before the Lord. So this is, I don't know if this is the rod of Moses or the rod of Aaron. It would make more sense to be the rod of Aaron, because Aaron's rod was actually placed in front of the Lord. But it doesn't seem to be Aaron's rod, because it's Moses is told to take his rod. So I assume that Moses kept his own staff in the tabernacle as well as the staff of Aaron. But be that as it may, Moses takes this staff from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And then Moses and his brother Aaron, they get everybody together in front of the rock. And here's what Moses says. He says, "Listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" And then Moses lifts up his hands, and he struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beast drank. Let me go ahead and finish this, and then we'll talk about the significance of this. So that happens, and then, verse 12, it says, "The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself holy among them. Now, there's been a lot of speculation as to exactly what the sin of Moses and Aaron was in this particular episode. I mean, everything from them striking the rock instead of speaking to it, to being angry with the people, to a focus upon a singular pronoun in something that Moses says. So one of the commentaries that I was looking at this morning said that the most significant word in verse 10 was "we," when Moses says, "Listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock?" In other words, accenting the fact that Moses, along with his brother Aaron, were attributing the ability to bring forth water from the rock to themselves instead of to the Lord. And you can look at a whole lot of other reasons that people have given over the years for exactly what the sin of Moses and Aaron was. Now, you can give me your opinion, Dan. For me, it seems like the most obvious is the one that we should go with here, because Moses is commanded explicitly to speak to the rock in front of the Israelites. And instead of doing that, he takes the rod and he not only strikes it once, but he strikes the rock twice, as if in anger against the Israelites. And water still comes forth from the rock, but the result is that he and his brother are going to be compelled to die outside of the promised land.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that you see that are different here. One, the roles seem to be reversed, because, as you said, God doesn't seem angry, but Moses does, which is different. Because normally it's God saying that he's about to kill everyone, and then and Moses interceding and asking him not to. In this instance, God just gives him instructions, doesn't seem angry. Even when he speaks to Moses afterwards, it sounds very matter of fact. It doesn't say like then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses or something like that. It just sort of says it. But Moses is obviously angry at this point. So I don't know if he's just old and frustrated. I mean, I don't blame him. I mean, at this point, he's just frustrated. I mean, he's probably tired of wandering around in the wilderness too.
And, when I'm 120 years old, I'll probably be pretty prone to anger myself.
Yeah, it's just had enough, man. And so you do see, I mean, you see it in the language he uses, you know, where he says, you know, "Listen up, you rebels." You know, I mean, that's it's right there. I mean, he doesn't say, "Listen, you people of Israel," or "Listen to listen, congregation." No, he gets up there and says, "Listen, you rebels." That reminds me of a pastor friend I have who I listened to one of his sermons. This is a couple of years ago, but. And this is not a bad, this is a good pastor, but got up in front of his congregation and started a sermon with, "Listen up, you God haters."
That'll get your attention right away.
That's essentially what Moses does here, but he doesn't do it to, you know, this guy does it to begin to preach the law and then bring the gospel. Moses is just angry, you know, and then he strikes the rock. But I think the sin is more obvious than we think. I think it tells us what the sin is, because God says to him, because you did not believe me. I think that means is that the sin of Moses is to not believe in the efficacy of the word being spoken. He seems to believe that he has to do something else. He has to strike this rock. Maybe you can understand it a little bit, since he's had to strike a rock before. God does tell him to grab his staff. You could be like, well, honest mistake. You said get the staff and then go get water out of this rock. And last time it involved hitting it. But what God says is that you didn't believe me. And it seems to me that Moses is angry and does not believe that he can simply speak to the rock, that he can speak essentially the word of the Lord, and that the word of the Lord will do what God has said it will do. And this seems to be what God, anyway, attributes as to Moses as his sin.
Yeah, and that would square with the same indictment that God has spoken against the Israelites in general. We saw this early in, I believe it was in the chapter where the Israelites refused to enter into the promised land. God says, because you did not believe me, you didn't trust me, therefore you will die in the wilderness, basically. So that means that, as we've seen multiple times, that's going to be the core problem of any sin, right? That's what prompts it, because you don't trust in the Lord, because you don't believe in him. Unfaith is the fountain from which all the poisonous sins flow. It's where it all begins. So it's unbelief, the lack of trust in the efficacy of the power of the word of God to do what it says, that leads Moses to do what he does. And as a result, Aaron will soon die at the end of this chapter. And then Moses will live on for a while, not much longer, long enough to preach that long, long sermon of Deuteronomy. But at the end of Deuteronomy, Moses himself will die outside of the promised land. And, you know, in many ways, in an ironic way, I guess, it seems fitting that Moses dies outside the promised land. I mean, Moses is the personification of the law. When you think of Moses, you think of the law. John himself says that, right? The law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So as the personification of the law, Moses is also a representative of the inability of the law to bring us into the promised land. And so for him to die outside of the promised land is a parallel to how far the law can get us, right? So the law can do much in revealing our sin and in pointing us in the right way, but it can't get us there. The law only leaves us with accusations of our imperfection. And it points the way toward righteousness, but it can't deliver it. It points the way to the promised land, but it can't provide the necessary grace by which to bring us into the promised land. That's going to be the work of Joshua, which is the Hebrew name for Jesus. So in a theological parallel, we can see that what happens with Moses and with Aaron and their deaths outside the promised land is exactly the way that things happen in our own lives when the law itself is working on us.
Yeah, I think it straight up shows you that not only can the law not get you into the promised land, but that the law cannot enter the promised land. The law goes into the grave before you walk into the promised land. We are waiting for a promised land. I mean, we are waiting for a new heavens and a new earth. I mean, this is what this is all about ultimately, right? Is that And the law doesn't go in there, and so there is that aspect of it. Paul uses Moses as an illustration of the law all the time, and while we certainly see and have seen over and over again Moses as a type and shadow of Christ, interceding for the people and this sort of thing. The main thing that the New Testament writers identify him with is the law, and rightfully so. I mean, the law came down with Moses from Sinai. And so while the law comes down through Moses from Sinai, Sinai does not enter the promised land. That's a good thing, too.
That is a good thing. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's not like, you know, some people will say that the new heavens and the new earth and the promise, there's sort of this thing, I don't understand it, but within Christendom where we have this, we're going to have Eden again. That is this kind of return to Eden is what we're after. It's not what we're after. It's not going to be like that. That's not what God has promised. That he doesn't say that we're going to rediscover Eden. He's going to have a new heavens and a new earth. That Eden also is burned up. And you don't want a new Eden because you don't want to redo all of this. And so in Eden, you do have the day you eat of the fruit of this tree, you shall surely die. You have this law there. And the law and the wages of that, of breaking that law, is death. It's the ultimate punishment. And we've been dealing with that ever since. That does not enter the new heavens and new earth. There is no command that the breaking of equals death in the new heavens and new earth in the promised land. And that's a good thing, because we don't want this endless cycle of having to do this, you know. So it's not like Eden in that sense, and it's not like Eden because Moses doesn't go there.
Yeah, it's much better. I mean, it's just like our bodies die and we await the resurrection. So the new the old heavens and the old earth also must experience death and be reformed as the new heavens and the new earth, just like our bodies will be reformed as new and glorious bodies.
Well, I heard one of my favorite theologians said, what happens, and when we enter the promised land and the new heavens and the new earth, is that we come out of the grave and the law goes into it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Because the law has nothing to say to us anymore, right? The law only speaks to sinners, and in the resurrection, sin is left behind us. And all that's left is the enjoyment of the presence of God and the love that God is pervading all of creation.
Yeah, that is 40 minutes. Well, you know, I thought, you know, we were going to get all the way to Aaron, but, you know, there was just, you know, too much to cover, man.
We'll pick it up. We'll pick it up there next time.
We will. Guys, make sure you grab those tickets if you want to come hang out with me and Chad and a whole bunch of other people. We're going to be talking about the common faith, jumping off of the Apostles' Creed. And so that's in next October. But, you know, if you wait until next October, you definitely won't be coming. So why don't you get that before the first of the year, before the prices go up. We'd love to hang out with you. Chad, I hope you have a very merry rest of the Christmas season.
I hope you do, too. And a happy new year.
Absolutely. We'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.